It is a beautiful, sunny, 80-degree Wednesday evening in Lansing. Thanks for joining us, Michael Cohen, with producer Nick Oren. On today's Capital City Recap, state Democrats say that it's too difficult for military servicemen and women to vote, and that Michigan's election law needs to be changed. I'll be joined by a state House candidate who's an Iraq War veteran to talk about that. And as emergency managers, and this law is now facing elimination with the November ballot proposal now officially set to go, officials in cities like Flint and Pontiac are moving to strip their emergency managers of their powers. But can they do it? And if so, where does that leave these struggling municipalities? Well, we'll find out. But first, with the jury now selected for the drunk driving trial of State Representative Bob Janetsky and the trial date set for September 24th, why is the state lawmaker proceeding with a case that's likely to keep his January 19th arrest in the news? And what are his prospects of being found not guilty after a Michigan State University police officer said he failed a field sobriety test? To find out, I'm joined by his attorney, well-known East Lansing drunk driving defense lawyer Mike Nichols, one of the top DUI experts in Michigan. Mike, thanks for joining us on WILS this evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Very good. Tell me,
it is a beautiful night, isn't it?
It is. You can't beat it, especially after all that rain. In terms of the majority of cases, though, aren't these DUI arrests usually not challenged in court and do not go to this full jury trial?
I don't necessarily agree. I think, just anecdotally speaking, Michael, a lot of people of profile, I've noticed, tend to plead their cases out. But a lot of at least the cases in my practice end up either going to trial or somehow getting litigated, because I think the theory has to be, if the government's not going to give me a reason to give up my right to go to trial, then why should I?
Now, in the Janetsky case here, the prosecution's bringing out the MSU police officer that arrested him, along with a phlebotomist from Sparrow Hospital, an analyst from the Michigan State Police Laboratory, and an additional witness from the State Police Toxicology Lab. Is this a typical roster of witnesses the prosecution calls on in a trial like this?
It's a typical roster of witnesses because that's what the prosecutor's required to produce.
I see. Now, each of these witnesses then are going to testify to each part of the test, I'm guessing, that, you know, this blood test that Bob Janetsky was given. How effective is that in front of a jury as each one of these folks get on the stand?
Well, I don't know because I haven't heard any testimony from these witnesses on these case facts. But I guess if this helps answer your question, every case is different. But every case is similar in that there is evidence in every case. The question is whether or not the evidence rises to the prosecutor's proof responsibility of beyond a reasonable doubt.
And one
thing that you said too, Michael, is I'm not sure that I've ever heard the arresting officer in this case say that Mr. Janetsky failed the field sobriety tests, but you know, even if he had, even if he did, I guess the question is based on what? I mean, I'm not aware of any, you know, great key in the sky that determines whether somebody who a police officer has ever met before has failed field sobriety.
So this test where someone steps out of the car and goes through a series of physical activities, is there any kind of official failure or passage, or that's just a term that might be thrown around?
I think in the media, perhaps in this case, I've seen that term thrown around, and maybe Officer Chrisman has put it somewhere that that I just don't recall or something, but, you know, even having said that, passing and failing, how do you determine that? What? It's sort of like when you watch gymnastics in the Olympics, you know, maybe one gymnast gets the gold and the other one gets the silver, but who passes and who fails? Well, no, I just don't get that.
I want to ask you about, by the way, I'm talking to Mike Nichols. He is the well-known East Lansing drunk driving defense lawyer, an expert in DWI and DUI cases. Now, MSU police officer Casey Chrisman, who did arrest Mr. Janetsky, is apparently leading his department in these drunk driving arrests, at least 25 of them each year from 2007 to 2010, more than 30 in 2011. Is there anything peculiar about his arresting record?
I don't know. I think it speaks for itself, and, you know, different people can draw different conclusions. I'm sure some people would say, wow, what a great police officer. And others may take a completely different, you know, approach to that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had Officer Chrisman on cases before. He seems like a gentleman and a nice young man, and, you know, that's...
Now yeah, he did not arrest Mr. Janetsky on any kind of a suspicion of drunk driving. There wasn't any kind of erratic driving, right?
I believe the basis for the stop was speeding.
Now, in most cases that you're dealing with, is it typical for an arrest not to be based on any kind of initial suspicion of drunk driving?
You know, there again, I mean, every case is different, Michael. Sometimes it's a case that starts off as a, you know, broken taillight. So everybody should, you know, after they finish listening to your great show, go check their car and make sure the brake lights are working and your license mm-hmm. plate tabs are not expired.
Now,
some cases start with speeding. Some cases start with a little bit of weaving. Some cases start with a 911 call where a person says, "I think this person in front of me is drunk."
Hmm.
They're all different.
Everyone has sped here or there. Now, I want to ask you: in this case, is it only a single blood test that was given? Then there were no breathalyzer tests at any point?
There was a blood test, which I think I can comment on because it's already been made public and is in the media. But yeah, there was a blood test, and that is the only chemical evidence of which I am aware.
Now, as a drunk driving defense attorney, is that the ideal situation for you? You want a single test, and at that point it's a court ordered test. You can't avoid that test, right?
The ideal situation for me is where I have seven people who are willing to decide my client's fate based on the facts as they are presented and proven by the prosecuting attorney, not six people, who will base it on their emotional response or this, you know, sort of negative, you know, political and social, you know, pariah that we've made this particular crime.
In terms of
ideal situation is people who will decide it on the facts and try to apply the law to the facts.
In terms of the technical aspects of the trial, though, it is you want to have a single test, not a whole series of them, right?
As a defense lawyer. That depends. Seven tests that are all screwed up are, you know, it's almost better than just one test that's slightly screwed
up. So obviously, if a case is going to trial at any point, or if the prosecution moves ahead, it's because there is a test that shows a blood alcohol level above 0.08. So as a defense attorney, are you basically, your position is to challenge that assertion? Are you basically getting to the scientific details as to why that was an inaccurate number?
Well, I neither want to unethically comment on the evidence in this case, nor would I want to tip trial strategy, and I'm sorry to do this, but I have to say, every case is different. Every case has its own approach, and this one is just like that.
And how do you deal with that societal view on drunk driving? Certainly, many, many Americans have some drinks, get in their car and drive, but there is a huge stigma there. How do you deal with that in terms of the jurors and getting them to maybe look at the client in a different light?
Well, I mean, part of the reason why I decided to dedicate my practice at this point in my life to the drunken drug driving defense is because I feel like those folks who are charged with those crimes are the underdogs. You know, I mean, I don't advocate drinking and driving, drinking illegally to the point where you're under the influence and endangering lives. And certainly I don't advocate excessive use of alcohol, but, you know, it's those folks are the underdogs. And just trying to get the jury to understand that they've got to base the case, and the judge, if you're arguing a motion or something like that, you know, what matters is what the law is and whether the facts support the charge beyond a reasonable doubt, or, you know, in the case of a, you know, potentially bad arrest, whether or not the judge should exclude evidence because an arrest was problematic or, you know, something like that.
Sure. One last question. Tell me, what percentage of your cases that go to trial, to a jury trial, approximately, end up with a not guilty verdict?
I don't keep stats. I can say I've certainly had my fair share of two-word verdicts. And whether it's been more two-word verdicts than one-word verdicts, it seems like it's been more two words than one word. But one-word verdicts, the guilty verdicts stick with you for so long.
Sure.
They seem like they count for two or three.
When someone is going to into trial into this situation, do you tell them it is essentially a 50-50 chance here?
No, I never say that because I don't have any data upon which to base that claim. You know, I'd be no better than a police officer saying the person was drunk because he couldn't walk heel to toe for nine steps and turn around and walk nine steps back.
Understood. Mike Nichols, East Lansing drunk driving defense lawyer. Mike, I hope we can talk again as the trial begins and ends and get some of your knowledge about our laws here.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you very much. Coming up next, we're going to talk about what Pontiac and Flint are trying to do with their emergency managers, and that is strip them of their power. What's that going to lead to anyway? We'll find out next. Michael Cohen, 1320 WILS.